Hey, Village Church, Pastor Mark here. So glad you are joining us across the world. We are online. We are in this COVID moment, and we are in this thing together, and we're learning the scriptures together, worshiping Jesus together. So hopefully you got family, friends, or if you're single, by yourself, zoned in, because this is the present form of church, the way we can do it. But we are expecting, praying into, getting back to gathering together as soon as we can. And this is going to be the year for that, Lord willing. So we are so jacked that you're here, so jacked that you're part of our church. And we really want you to actually like get involved in our church. So rather than just watching the sermons, sign up for community group, sign up for a ministry, make sure we know who you are so we can actually shepherd you, Pastor. You have people from all kinds of different provinces and in the United States and different countries around the world. And our online pastor, Pastor Zach, actually takes people and organizes them into groups depending on where you actually are. So if there's 10 of you watching in Wisconsin, for instance, then he'll actually get you guys together so that you can chat and talk and meet up, whatever you need to do. So we want to actually do that. And across Canada, we want people to do that. We plan on planting a couple of churches this year in Winnipeg and Toronto. And so we're super excited about those. And who knows what else is going to happen. We got a couple other things brewing, and we're super excited about the mission of Jesus, because church planting didn't stop, evangelism didn't stop just because of COVID. So glad you're here. If you got a Bible, open it to John chapter 1. We are continuing this on. Last week, we talked about the idea. We started alluding to this idea that there were going to be people that follow Jesus. And now we see it here in verse 37, speaking of the guys who were interested in Jesus before. And it says, they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, what are you seeking? And we ended last time on that awesome question. And they said, Rabbi or Rabboni, all right, for the Italians among us. This is a really interesting thing, which means teacher. So you have this concept of following Jesus. They start to follow him, and then they're looking for, so a rabbi, this is what we have to understand about that time. A rabbi, back then, it literally meant great one. And it was a master to a student. And in that culture, like every culture, they would look to a teacher to define for them what was a priority. It was literally called, you would sit and you would get the dust of your rabbi, because you would follow your rabbi around and they would define life for you, God for you, what you're supposed to do with your life. And so it's like a mentor, like Skywalker had Obi-Wan Kenobi, Frodo has Gandalf, you know, over all these stories have this idea that a mentor pours into a kid or someone underneath them and develops not only the way they think, but the way they behave, what they actually do with their life. And the reason he actually does it, remember, he does this for 3 years. He's their rabbi. Actually, that would have been one of the things, probably quicker than savior, they would have related to Jesus as rabbi. Jan David Hedegaard, who's a philosopher, said, the question of leadership is the most important question in the universe. Who leads you? Who's your leader? Is Jesus your teacher, not just your savior? You understand that he formed a kind of life. The reason he lived all those for 3 years. See, oftentimes we've done a really good job in the church at defining why Jesus died, but we're not always sure why he lived. Why did Jesus live? To bring the kingdom and to model, as the old Latin phrase, Christus exemplar. He is an example for us as we come under. Dallas Willard, actually, who was a philosopher who passed away a few years ago, he talks about the idea that student or apprentice to a master is actually the paradigm of Christianity in the New Testament. 269 times in the New Testament, the word disciple is used, or student, or apprentice of a master, and 3 times the word Christian is used. That this is the paradigmatic model of Christian life in the New Testament, is discipleship. I'm an apprentice under a master. And this is why even 1 John chapter 2, which is this beautiful verse in the New Testament, my friend texted me the other day. I was sitting studying sermon stuff. It was on a Saturday night, getting ready for it to preach. And she texted me. It was a little bit ago. Her and her family were out. And they were wrapping all these things for these people in need and kind of taking pictures of their family doing this work. And I'm kind of sitting at home, you know, working on my stuff. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's actually what Jesus like looks like. And so I sent her a text of this verse, 1 John chapter 2. Whoever says he abides in him, meaning Jesus, ought to walk in the same way in which he walked. There's this exhortation to not just believe in Jesus, guys, but to walk like he walked, to love like he loved, to forgive enemies like he forgave enemies, to do sexuality the way that he would define it, to do money the way, to do family, to do your job, to do work, to be single, the way that Jesus as rabbi. Do you wear the dust of Jesus on your life so much so that people look? And here's what we got to understand about it. It's not like there's Christians, and then there's like the deluxe version of Christians, which would be disciples, right? And some of you are like, yeah, but I'm a Christian, but like maybe I'm not a disciple. That's not how this works. It's not like you go, it's a fast food restaurant, and you go and it's like, you want to like supersize it? And you go, yeah, I like to supersize it. That's not what a disciple, it's not a supersized version of Christianity. It is the paradigm. It is the question you need to ask your life. Not just do you believe in him, but do you follow him? Is he your rabbi? Is he your teacher? That's defining how you think. A.W. Tozer said any other version of Christianity is what he called a heresy. He called it vampire Christianity, where we just focus on justification and making sure we're going to heaven when we die and make sure my sin is forgiven. Let me take a bit of your blood, Lord. But not worry about walking with you in the now, about who I'm going to become in the present time. And so Dallas Willard talks about the idea that you have a whole bunch of people who have faith over here and abundant life over here. And of course, this is what we want. You have this, but abundant life over here. And Willard said the reason that we don't have abundant life, but we might have faith, is because the bridge between the two is discipleship. That's what you're missing. That's the method by which you move from here to here. You're wondering why, where's the joy, where's the meaning, where's the fulfillment? Discipleship is the way there. And so he says, we've got a whole bunch of people who believe in Jesus, that he died for their sins, but they're not believing in Jesus for everything else. Think about that for your life, every part of your life. You know what I've never been asked to do as a pastor? I've been asked to pray for a lot of things. I'm asked to give advice to a lot of things. I've never been asked for stock market advice. No one's ever come to me and said, should I take my money from here and put it in this stock? Can we pray about this right now? Can you fast for me? I got a disease I need healed, but I don't have a lot of, should I take this opportunity for a promotion at work? As a pastor, can you pray and fast with me? See, do you bring Jesus into everything? That's what he's trying to say. And so one writer has said this, we have multitudes of professing Christians who well may be ready to die for Jesus, but obviously are not ready to live for him. They can hardly get along with themselves, much less others. See, it's this concept. I look at some of you and I think you are courageous enough to die for Christ, but that actually may be easier than what it means to live for him. Because that's gonna take sacrifice. That's gonna mean obedience. That's gonna mean becoming a student, shaping my very life, the character traits. See, that's what spiritual formation is. It might be easier to die for you than to actually live for him. And so why does he do this? Why does he say, follow me? Why does he call these guys to follow? Why does he want them to be their rabbi? Because he knows it's the best thing, not for him and his ego. He's not me on Instagram trying to get more likes. He knows it's the best thing for them. He knows it's the best thing for you. It's the best way your life runs. That's the offer of discipleship. It's the best way. The universe runs best when it's done in the form that God himself does it. This is why it's like a car. I'm so bad at cars. I went in for I was meeting with a banker a little bit ago, and he was asking me about like my assets. I was telling my buddy this the other day. I'd forgotten about it, that he was asking me, and I didn't know anything about it because I don't care about cars. So I'm like, I don't know. He's like, do you own your car? I'm like calling my wife. I'm like, do I own my car? No, I lease my car. And so the gas light goes on, or the oil light. Right now on my truck, there's an oil light. It says, you need to change your oil. I don't even know. I've never even done that to a car before. I don't know how these things run, but it's probably best if I get my oil changed. It means the engine's going to run properly. He's going, without trying to look like me, as your teacher, as your rabbi, your life ain't gonna run properly. It's like you're running without oil changes or gas, or you're not paying attention to the details. This is for your good, not my good. That's the point. Now, if we become his followers, then we're going to, discipleship means that we don't follow anything else in the world ultimately, that we get undiscipled from all other forms of discipleship. And we're being discipled all the time. Every promotion, every marketing scheme, every education piece, every radio, every time we go on the news, we're being discipled. It means to become a learner of, or you're starting to think in those ways. And to become disciple of Jesus means that we need to be formed, almost deformed, away from those ways of the world, so that we can be formed into the ways of Jesus. The ways of the kingdom means we have to come off all of the other ways we're being discipled to the ways of him, off the dominant ideologies of our time. And that means, and this is what's hard about it, there's going to be a cost in real life to us if we follow him. Because of course, later in John, he's gonna go, by the way, if they killed me, they're gonna kill you. If they persecute me, they're gonna persecute you because I'm your rabbi. You're my student in the world representing what I say and do. Okay, let me give you an example from Canadian politics. All right, now this is not, I'm not telling you I'm a right, conservative, left, liberal. I'm not saying any of that, so save your emails and your tweets. All right, this is just an example and an illustration, okay? In 2004, our Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, required, I'm reading from an article, that all Liberal Party members vote pro-choice in Parliament or they were to be removed from the party caucus, all right? So it's interesting to set a line like that because, of course, in the Liberal Party, you have people of all different religions and ideas and worldviews, and yet he sets this line about pro-choice in regard to abortion. And there's an assumption in that move that says that religion is an accessory to life. It's like not central. It's not going to, all I'm asking you to do is vote in this particular way, whatever your religious view. That's the assumption in his brain. But the reality is that's not how religious life goes. That's everything. And so one commentator says this: what kind of politics are they which require an MP to denounce his deepest moral commitments and declare he's in favor of ideas and actions that his faith condemns, his church forbids, and his conscience cannot abide? See, sometimes in life, even at the political level or the technology level or the money level or the work level or the marriage level, discipleship creeps in and you can't set it aside as something other than central to how you are. And are you willing to take the risks that you might lose a job in regard to discipleship, for instance? Or something might be, see, this is the cost of discipleship. This is what Jesus meant when this is gonna be hard. On the flip side, you have a story I read years ago. There was a guy who used to do prison ministry, and there was this one gangster in prison and he became a Christian. And when he got out, he continued to be a gangster. And this guy caught up with him. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I'm just a Christian gangster. There's Christian lawyers, there's Christian rock stars, and now I'm a Christian gangster. And he's like, no, that doesn't work. You can't be like killing people and selling drugs and being a, you know, pimping out prostitutes and be a Christian at the same time. And the comment was, he wanted to be a Christianized version of what he already was and was determined to remain. That's not discipleship. That's what's hard and beautiful about what Christianity offers. It's not just a belief system. It gets down to the level of who you are and how you are in the world. And if we aren't willing to go, this stuff affects my life, then I'm not sure we're Christians. I'll give you an example of this. I was doing marriage counseling a few years ago with this couple, and they're kind of going through struggles, and the wife had said, there's a few things I need you to stop doing. You got to stop doing this, stop doing this, stop doing this. And the third thing was, I need you to stop hanging out with this particular guy. You hang out with him, he's a bad influence on your life. I don't want you hanging out with him anymore. No hanging out with Jason. So the guy's like, okay, fine. And then month one, month two, month three, I keep checking in with them. And he keeps telling me, oh, but Jason needs me. She keeps getting mad at me, but I keep hanging out with Jason. So he wanted to say two things at the same time. On the one hand, he wanted to say, I will do anything to fight for my marriage. On the other hand, he couldn't stop hanging out with his bro, Jason. And it's like, hey, then you won't do anything to save your marriage because your wife has just asked you to stop hanging out with Jason. You see, discipleship of Jesus doesn't mean just beliefs. It means obedience. It means not that your belief system changes. It's your behavioral, actional. And this is why Jesus is going, listen, sometimes the way into the kingdom is a formation of a life, a deformation off the dominant ideologies of the world, and a reformation of your entire life around me. Is that your life yet? Have you taken Jesus on as following him, rabbi, and teacher? So then it says this, where are you? Pick up the rest of the story. Verse 39, where are you staying? They said. And he said to them, come and you will see. So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who had heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. Now we're gonna talk about Simon Peter, because of course he becomes like the central person in the history of the church. Now you have Andrew first, and he's Simon Peter's brother. So my brother's name is Matthew. It's like I go and find Jesus, and then I go get Matt, and I bring Matt because I want Matt to meet Jesus. Like, this is crazy. This is my brother's son. So Andrew meets him, and then he goes and gets Simon, and he first found his own brother Simon and said to him, we have found the Messiah, which means Christ. Of course, these are Jews waiting for the Messiah to come. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, you are Simon, the son of John. There's lots of Johns going on. Very confusing. There's the writer. There's this. Everyone's name is John. It's like those like Italian families, you know. It's like, hey, you know, you're meeting everybody. It's like, there's John, there's Pete, there's Petey, there's Peter. You know, there's Tony and little Tony and Tony Jr. and Tony. You know, all of that. That's the way it was back then. And you will be called Cephas, which means Peter. And this word is the word Petros, which means rock. All right. And so he says, you are Simon. I'll get back to that in a second. But what I love about honing in on Simon Peter for a few minutes is it raises the question when we talk about all this discipleship stuff. It raises the question for me, who qualifies to be a disciple of Jesus? Because some of you are sitting there going, I'm a disaster. You don't know the pornography I looked at last night. You don't know the mistakes I made. You don't know what I'm hiding from my spouse. You don't know how I spend my money. You don't know that I'm part of a different religion. You don't know that I go to psychics and try to figure out you don't know about all the secret things that I do. What kind of, you don't know who I maybe murdered. Like, there's people all through the Bible who murder. I mean, maybe you're racist. Maybe you know these things about you, and you're saying, it's great to say I'm supposed to be a disciple, but you don't know who I am, man. I'm not good enough. And Peter is going to give you the encouragement that you need. The imperfect person qualifies. See, Peter goes on. We don't know this yet if we're just following the story. He's a disaster. He asks every stupid question in the book. He fumbles around. He starts sinking when he's walking on water. He goes back. If you read the rest of the story, you go to the end of, you know, John chapter 19, 20, 21. You know what Peter does after he lives these three crazy years with Jesus? He goes back to fishing. Like, literally, Jesus finds him in his comfort place. Like, it'd be like if Jesus came and disrupted your entire life and you know, Peter, actually, we know from other books that he has a mother-in-law. So he's married, which is kind of crazy. Maybe he becomes a disciple of Jesus because the mother-in-law is driving him nuts. But he goes and he starts to follow Jesus. And then Jesus does all this stuff and he says, you're going to change the world. And then Jesus dies and he goes back and just starts fishing again because he was a fisherman. And he's like, I don't know, this is what I know. This is comfortable for me. And maybe that's you. You're like, yeah, I want to follow Jesus, but I want to do what's comfortable. And then Jesus says, what is that you're doing? And then they go on this walk in John 21, and John, the writer of this, is there, and Peter keeps asking, he's like, hey, am I going to be like him? And hey, what's going on with my life? And he's constantly just nagging, kind of an annoying guy. See, he's an imperfect guy, which gives us all hope. In fact, this word Petros, it can mean like solid, rock, but it can also mean, and here's the joy for us, kickable pebble. That's what this word means. Jesus nicknames him, which is great. He goes, your name is Simon. I'm going to call you Cephas, Peter, Petros, kickable rock. He's nicknaming him. I love this. My buddies had nicknames back in the day. My best friend was, his nickname was Nipple. His nickname was Nipple. So yeah, you know, you don't really realize till you haven't said the word nipple a lot that like kind of a weird thing to say 28 times a day, you know, when you're sitting in school, hey, Nipple, pass me a pencil. So Nipple was a big one, a nickname that we had. I mean, that didn't sound right. We had all kinds of nicknames for it. We called my buddy Cone because his head was all coned. See, we were such nice guys. But here's the thing about nicknames. And let me make a kind of deep point out of this. Nicknames are something you give to someone because of kind of their historical, like they've done stuff or they look a certain way or whatever. So you nickname them that. What I love about this is Jesus is saying where your life is going to go. You're a disaster, but here's where your life is going to go. You're going to become a central feature of the entire church. You're going to help birth the church, Peter. You preach the first Christian sermon. You're one of the great leaders that's going to spread Christianity. I'm going to call you rock now, even though now it might be kickable pebble, but it's going to be unbelievable. Listen, there's an encouragement for me and you. He takes the regular Joe Blow, who's made a whole bunch of mistakes. You looked at that stuff, I know. You did that thing, I know. You hid that secret, you lied that time, I know. Kickable rock, but you're going to become Petros, stone, immovable, if you put your hands in the life of Jesus. That's what he's trying to say to Peter, and that's what he's saying to us. But forget the mistakes you've made. Maybe life is just beaten up on you, and you need, as one writer, I'm reading a book called People of the Second Chance, and maybe that's what you need. Life is, he gives the image of toothpaste comes out of the bottle, and it out of the tube, and you can't get it back in, and that's life sometimes. That's Peter, mistake-ridden. Sometimes it's not even mistakes, it's life beats up on you. You have a diagnosis, maybe you lost a child, maybe you're divorced, maybe, and you feel all the shame and the guilt and the pain of all of this. It's out of the tube. The mess is made. But then Jesus takes all that mess and he does something with it. People of the second chance and the third chance and the 18th chance and the 77th chance. That's why Jesus constantly teaches, how many times are you going to forgive? 70 times 7. So many times I'm going to forgive you. The infinite amount of times, even though maybe your spouse isn't giving you that second chance right now, or maybe your kids have stopped giving you that, or that workplace, or whatever. Jesus will. Circumstances may not. Jesus will. Because he's going to make you into something. And it's in that place when you start to recognize your own frailty that he can do work like that. Let that be an encouragement to you. Cynthia Oselli, she's a writer, says this, for a seed, like of a plant or a tree, to achieve its great expression, it must come completely undone. The shell cracks, its insides come out and everything changes. To someone who doesn't understand growth, it would look like complete destruction, right? That's some of our lives. They are cracking apart. The insides are coming out. We got nowhere to go. And that's the only way a seed becomes what it's meant to be, to grow into a thing. And it looks like destruction, you know, to quote The Dark Knight, the night is darkest just before the dawn. Jesus can do something in your life that you can't even imagine. I have a friend who cheated on his wife, was hanging out with all the big players. He was hanging out with Tiger Woods and Charles Barkley and going on trips to Vegas. He was flying in private jets with Mark Cuban. He was the man. And then he was down in Vegas one day, had flown in a private jet, and he's hanging out with all these guys and girls everywhere. And all of a sudden, he just felt this overwhelming sense of crushing. And it was the beginning of a new life for him. He walked away from all of his bags. He left them sitting in the private jet. And he got a Southwest airline flight home, walked into his front, looked at his wife and said, fell on the floor and said, I confess everything to you. We need to build a new life. And then they started going to church and he met Jesus. It's like Jesus was hunting him down before. That moment of cracking must have felt awful, but it was the beginning of a whole new life for him. And that's the moment you might be in right now. And that's the hope that we actually hold on to. Peter was the guy who was both carnal and spiritual, right? That's just who he was. So some of you right now, you just feel that way. But here's what you got to know. One writer has put it this way. No person is what they are in their own eyes. They really are only as they are known to God. No person is what he himself thinks he is. He is only what Jesus knows him to be. And so some of you think you're dumb, you're ugly, you're not worthy. How would God ever use me? That's Peter. And Jesus goes, I want you. I'm going to do something with your life. I know it feels like it's cracked and a mess and a disaster. I'm going to do something with your life that you might not even understand right now. And so the next day, verse 43, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. That's where he hung out. Now, one of these days, a couple of weeks, I'll put a map up so you can kind of gauge what's going on here. But Jesus grew up in the rural reality of Galilee, a fishing town, far away from Jerusalem, the kind of the main hub of theological elitism. He was far away from that, and this is where he did his life. And he found Philip, and he said to him, follow me. Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And so it says, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses, so Philip's, Nathanael's jacked up. Nathanael meets Jesus, goes back, tells Philip, here's what's, and what I love about that is that Spurgeon years ago said, you're either a missionary or you're an imposter, right? Either Jesus has got a hold of your life and you want to go and tell everybody about it or not. And you have 1,000 choices every day, but if Jesus has moved you and you've met him and you started to follow him, then of course you're going to do what Andrew did. Go get some. You're going to do what Nathanael did. I want to tell people about this moment I've had. This is why we as a church, we don't just focus on Christians. We want to do evangelism as a church. We want to tell people who don't already know. And maybe that's you. And maybe you're part of another religion. And maybe you're an atheist or an agnostic. We are glad that you are here. We're glad you're exploring Jesus with us. I'm telling you, like Nathanael, I had a personal experience with Jesus Christ, and I want you to as well, because he solves your life and gives you new purpose and meaning and joy that you could never imagine. He saves you from yourself. He saves you from the wrath of God. He saves you where your life goes without him. And so the main thing he says here, though, is that we found the one that the law and the prophets wrote about, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. So what he's saying is, hey, you know that Bible that we've been reading our whole life that talked about this one who is going to come? You know him? He actually, and here we have this opportunity to understand the doctrine of the Bible, which is really important part of our life. You see, when you relate to the Bible, you might read it or do your devos in it or hear it preached or whatever, but there's this question of what is it actually about? That's a pretty foundational. What is the Bible about? And oftentimes, those of you raised in the church, you hear that the Bible is about you, right? You're not courageous, so be courageous like David. Slay the giants in your life. Slay the fear. Slay the courage. Be like Abraham. Have some faith. Be like Esther. Be a leader who can. We do all this stuff, and then we start to read it, and we start to get discouraged because then we're like, we're none of these people. The Bible doesn't seem to have a place for people like me, and that's to misunderstand. It's like I was talking to my assistant, Erin, a couple months ago, and she had brought her daughter into the office, her little daughter, Vanna, and Vanna was sitting outside our office, and me and Erin had this meeting for half an hour inside my office. And of course, I talk, you know, animated in life, right? And I talk, you know, my volume may not be as low as some people, and everything's like a big deal, and everything's like said like apocalyptically in my life. And so I'm telling stories, and we're doing something as easy as booking calendars, and I'm ready. And she goes home, and Vanna looks at her in the car, and she said, Mommy, why does that man yell at you? And I felt terrible, right? What a terrible model. Why would you yell at a woman? But it's like, it's just how I talk. I just yell all the time. And so that's a misread of what was going on. It's a misinterpretation. And the reality is, some of you misinterpret what the Bible's about to far more of a destructive reality in your life. Because ultimately, This is, look at what he says here. The law and the prophets, they wrote, right? They wrote about, what were the law and the prophets, what did they write about? Jesus. Either the Bible is about you or it's about him. And if it's about him and not you, it changes everything. Because how many people have walked away from the church thinking the Bible is basically saying, you can never live up to me. Stop smoking. Stop looking at that. Stop spending like that. Stop thinking like that. Stop gossiping like that. And crush, crush, crush. And we leave because we know we can't. I did young adult ministry for 6 years. How many of them left the church because the Bible seemed to be saying a whole bunch of stuff they didn't want to do with their life at all, and I don't want to be part of it. That's if the Bible's about you. But if he's right and the Bible's about Jesus, then the whole thing changes. Because it's about the fact that Jesus had to be courageous for you because you're not. And it's about the fact that you're not supposed to be David. Jesus was David for you. See, there's a writer, he points this out in this in this great way where he talks about Jesus as the true and better. You know, one of my daughter's books is called the Jesus Storybook Bible, and the sub kind of point is every story whispers his name, right? The idea that the gospel weaves itself through the whole Bible. And this one writer puts it this way, Jesus is the true and better Adam who passed the test in the garden and whose obedience is imputed to us. Jesus is the true and better Abraham who answered the call of God to leave all the comfortable and familiar and to go out into the void, not knowing whither he went to create a new people of God. Jesus is the true and better Isaac who was not just offered up by his father on the mount, but was truly sacrificed for us. And when God said to Abraham, now I know you love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son whom you love from me. Now we can look at God taking his son up the mountain and sacrificing him and say, now we know that you love us because you did not withhold your son, your only son whom you love from us. Jesus is the true and better Joseph, who at the right hand of the king forgives those who betrayed him and sold him and uses his new power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Jonah, who is cast out into the storm so that we could be brought in. Jesus is the real rock of Moses, the real Passover lamb, the real temple, the true prophet, the true priest, the true king, the true sacrifice, the true light, the true bread. See, the Bible's not about you. That's what he's realizing. The Bible's about him. And because it's about him, we find salvation in him that changes everything. And so it says, Nathanael said to him, I love this line. Look at this. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Mic drop, jerk. Hey, Nathanael, we found the Messiah. Oh yeah, where is he hanging out? Oh, he's like born in Bethlehem, Nazareth. Ah, that's a dump. Hicktown, as one writer says, you know, they probably think pro wrestling is real and eat Hot Pockets a lot. Hicktown, Nazareth, nothing good can come out of there. Not the right guy. This is what our challenge is, and it's beautiful. We tend to follow royalty and cool people and politicians and good-looking people and people who have lots of followers. This is what we do. And he goes, oh, he's from the slum. He's from Calcutta. He's from Haiti. What good can come from those places? Well, I look back at my own life. What good can come of my life? What... can anything good come out of Ajax? That's where I'm from. Ajax, Ontario. Not exactly the elite town of Canada. You know, our claim to fame is my buddies were in a band called Sum 41. All right, they were all my buddies in high school. So Sum 41 came out of Ajax. Ding! All right, what good can come out of, I mean... it's not the highest economic class in the world. My parents were divorced. My dad was a deadbeat. I got into drugs when I was young, stealing stuff. I mean, what good can come out of a life that starts like that, a place like Ajax? I mean, people look at me now, even my marriage. My wife posted these pictures the other day on her Instagram account about our dating years. What is that? It's like she's doing her ventriloquist act here. All right, she looks like she's a towering giant and I'm a child that just came out of the crate. We're dating right here. I'm 20 years old. I look like I'm 49 pounds and, you know, prepubescent. But the reality, I mean, look at it. It's just, it's crazy. Now, it's just the way she happened to be sitting. But I mean, people look at that and they go, how does she with you? Which continues to be the question. How is it possible that this woman is, what must, you know, how good must my skills be, you know, to keep this woman near to me? Look at this. This is our honeymoon. What am I wearing? I'm wearing parachutes on my legs and my legs and my socks. My legs are sticks. What's happening? How is this possible? Can any good come out of Ajax? How is it even possible? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? This is exactly what the beautiful part of the gospel is, actually, is that yes, I can take this nonsense kid and do something with his life, maybe. I don't know. He's a wreck. Look at those socks and the pants. Maybe I'll do something with him. I don't know. But in the hands of God, anything is possible. So don't doubt your own life. If you need to use me as an example, go, okay, that's a miracle from the Lord. Miracles exist. All right, I'm in. So here's what he says. Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said, behold, an Israel. Here, go back here for a sec. Come here. I love this. First, before we get to that. Okay, look at this. Come and see. Come and see. I love that. I've had this amazing experience. I want you to actually come and see. Jesus is unreal. Church is unreal. God is unreal. If your life is boring, why would anyone come and see what your life is about? Ask that question. Is anyone looking and wanting to come and see? See, I'm going to come and see fireworks. I'm going to come and see a whale in the ocean. I'm not going to come and see grass growing. Come and see means there's something exciting to actually see. What are you inviting people to see? Is your life such exciting, passionate, that people want to see what's behind it or not? What are they coming and seeing? Are you inviting anybody to come and see anyway? This is the definitive reality of the Christian life. Are you inviting anyone to come and see? Any neighbor, any family, any friends? And when they come and see, what are they seeing? A boring life where your main priorities are just, you know, hitting the mortgage and going on with your life and make sure you hopefully raise some good kids and go to bed by 9. Is this your dream? Do you have something interesting about you that transcends every moment of suffering that says I'm for something? My whole life is tied around something else, something bigger from this Messiah that I've met that came from this background of born and stay, just a non-event. And he changed everything. Is there something about your life? There's a story told about Thomas Huxley, who was an agnostic. He was called Darwin's bulldog at the time. He was just a philosopher and a writer that was all about Darwinism and atheism and agnosticism in particular. He didn't go to church. He made fun of people who did. But one day he was walking. It was a Sunday and all of his friends had gone to church and he found a guy. He was walking to church and he said, I want you to come in my house and I want you to tell me about Christianity. Tell me about Jesus. Tell me about this God that you follow. And the guy knew who Thomas Huxley was. And he said, I can't argue with you about Christianity. And Huxley's like, no, I don't want you to argue with me. I want you to just come in the house. We'll have some tea. And I want you to tell me specifically your life and what you love, what Christ means to you. I'm not here to argue. I just want to know what Christ means to you. And the man spent the afternoon telling Huxley all about his life and what Jesus meant to him. And the story is, I was reading in a book, it says, Huxley, with tears at the end of the conversation, said these words, I would give my right hand if only I could believe that. He didn't argue, Huxley. He wasn't clever argument. It was, let me tell you what Jesus has done in my life, the value of it. That's what people are going to believe, guys. And every single one of you can do that. You don't have to be brilliant to tell people what Christ means to you, to show them his worth, to show them his value. Now, let me end by focusing in on this word within a word, see. Come and see. See has, it's a theme in itself in the Gospel of John. We want to see. In John chapter 20, you see the writer of this book and Simon Peter, and they're running to the tomb. And it says in verse 3, so Peter went out with the other disciple and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And we find out later that the other disciple is John. He's the guy writing this. So he's kind of doing like, I was a faster runner than Peter, you know, no big deal. And then he said, they get in, they stoop down and they look. And it says, if you read it, he says, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there and the face cloths, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths. Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went and he saw three times and believed. And we start to understand the way John uses words. He wants you to come and see, but he wants you to see. Like, not just see Jesus, like some of you are right now, but see him. Like, see and believe. Come and see, but I don't want you to just look at data. I want you to value him. I want you to treasure him. I want you to believe in him. I want you to have faith in him. This is literally, a couple verses later, what John tells us the purpose of him writing the whole book is. In John chapter 20, in verse 31, he says, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you have life in his name. I want you to have faith. I want you to believe. Now, let me just tell you something. Sometimes I want to talk, some of you right now, you're like, yeah, but you know, I'm looking at the data, and I'm just not convinced that I got to continue thinking, and that's good, that's beautiful. But there is going to come a point, I'll give you a warning. There's going to come a point where what your reason will have to give way to something. And here's my example of this. I drew on this before we started so you can see. You see these two arrows? So if you look at these two arrows, just tell the people around you which one has the longer line in the middle, the bottom or the top. Bottom or the top, which line is longer in the middle? Of course, we look at it, the bottom. Bottom looks longer, looks like that line. The reality is both of those middle lines are the exact same size. One just looks longer than the other. And I was reading a psychology book the other day and they made this point and said, sometimes we can't trust our senses. Sometimes we have to actually come to a point where we don't trust our senses, where sometimes they're giving us data that seems to be one way, but we've got to understand that it's not actually that way. We have to go beyond it. We have to see, but then we got to like see, because sometimes our brains can play tricks on us. I was reading the story of Air France 447 the other day, May 31st, 2009, look it up. Crashed with 240 or 50 passengers, went into the ocean, and they have the black box tape. And the black box tape is the pilots all fighting each other because all of the data seems to be saying that they were going down, and he kept pulling the nose up and up. And as he pulled the nose up, the plane would start saying it's going to stall, and he thought he was only at kind of almost going thing, but he was at this high pitch. And then the plane started, and as he's going, he thought he was pulling up, but he was actually pushing it down, and they're all arguing, and you hear the black, what are you doing? You need to pull up. He's like, I'm pulling up. And the plane just continued to go down at 10,000 feet per minute. And they all argue for 10 minutes in the plane, trying to figure out what's going on, until finally the clouds clear, they see the ocean, and you just hear the guy say, what's happening? And it's over. Brilliant minds. All the math seemed to be right. Everything, all the instruments seemed to be telling one story, but all the senses were wrong. They did what psychologists call cognitive tunneling, and instead of thinking, they were reacting. You know, psychologists tell us there's a world of difference between thinking and evaluating something through a clear heart and a clear mind and reacting. And my fear for some of us is that you're not coming and seeing the evidence and the offer. You're reacting to it and it's skewing you. That could end up in disaster. And so the offer of John is continuously what it is, and the offer of Village Church to you is continuously what it is. At some point, you have faith in Jesus. It's a bit of a leap. You run the ramp of reason and take the leap of faith. Because sometimes our gut's telling us one thing, but we can't trust it. And then you begin to see, and as John says, and believe. That's my hope, my vision, Lord, for the people watching this and listening to this right now, that they wouldn't just see these stories and see this text, but they would see, they would believe, they would begin, for many of them, watching this from all these different countries and whatever context they're in. Some of them were atheists, agnostics, that they would take the leap of faith, that they would invite Jesus in and recognize that once that happens, they will become come and see people to the beautiful, abundant life that they couldn't have any other way. And that sometimes life around them is giving them all kinds of messages. The instruments seem to be saying we're fine or we're going up when in fact we're going down. And people around us seem to be affirming us in who we are and where we're at. But this is not data that is actually true. So let us hear your voice and let us follow into the tomb and then see the empty tomb and the reality of the resurrection like these guys did and then see and then believe. And let us have those miracles that follow. Change the direction of our very life and our affections. Lord, do that among us by the thousands, even right now. In Jesus' great name we pray. Amen.